So this is the Where Do Science Fiction and Science Fact Meet panel, but it's just me, the bald futurist, here to talk to you. What I'm going to do is talk for about 45 minutes, kind of talk about the work that I do a little bit at Intel to kind of give you an idea of how we use science fiction as a development tool for science fact. And then after 45 minutes, we'll take questions. And the only thing that Fernando and everybody else has told me, because we're podcasting this, please get prepared to get up and talk into the microphone so everybody else in the podcast can hear you. First off, one of the reasons I love speaking at South by Southwest, who has an alcoholic beverage in their hand? Raise it high. Thank you so much. Oh, look, there's the guy who brought it in. I should tip that guy right there. Because that mob over there are going to think my jokes are so funny. There we go. Yay! All right, so we'll just walk through that, and I want to kind of talk to you about, literally, in the work that we're doing at Intel, but also it's actually much larger, where the worlds of science fiction and science fact are actually kind of coming together in some really interesting ways, and in things really only in the past couple years that have actually been able to happen. So we'll walk through. I've got some slides. This first slide, if you look really closely, says, I work for Intel, and we have a lot of lawyers. Okay, we're done. So who am I? My name is Brian David Johnson. I'm Intel's futurist. I'm Intel's first futurist, and it's my job to look 10 to 15 years out and create models for how people will act and interact with technology. Basically, if it has a chip in it, it's within my landscape. And the reason why, and it's not science fiction, actually, the reason why I do that is because to build the chips inside of Intel takes about 5 to 10 years. So it's incredibly pragmatic. We need to know today what people may want to do in 10 years from now so that we can build that into the chip. I'm literally working on the 2019 chip right now. But how I sort of come to this is I'm kind of half and half. I'm half principal engineer and I'm also a designer. So it's kind of the being able to sort of do software and do code, but at the same time kind of do design and storytelling as well. Now, if you look at this picture of me up on the screen, you can pretty much tell everything you need to know about me by this picture. So you can look that the guy there on the left, that's me. The guy on the right is Arthur. And Arthur is the first robot that was ever created by the University of Essex Robotics Lab in the UK, in the United Kingdom. Like I said, you can pretty much tell everything you need to know about me by that picture, pretty much evidenced by the fact that I went all the way to the UK and had my picture taken with a 20-year-old robot. You people can rest assured, I am a freaking geek. I love everything science and everything science fiction, and what I'm really excited to do today is that's actually what we're going to talk about, the sort of coming together of science fiction and science fact. So that's my background. Now, one of the things that we do in the kind of building of these platforms, of these computational devices, and having a vision for where they're going to go, is we have to have a vision, right? First off, we've got to say, all right, what do we think the future is going to look like so that we can actually go and build it? So typically when we're shown pictures of the future, we see pictures that look like this, right? You've got the really good-looking guy or the really good-looking girl. You've got the really cool streamlined device, and they're sort of set around this really streamlined, ultra-urban, ultra-modern room, right? We see this in science fiction. We see this in advertising. And when I see this, I hate this picture. I hate everything about this picture. Because if we're trying to do the real work of building and speccing out the future, it can't look like this picture. Now, I can say this, by the way, because this image comes from Intel, my company, which, as you can imagine, doesn't make me a lot of friends in the marketing department at all. But that's okay. Because when I look at this as a designer and as an engineer, what I think of is, where are the baby toys? Where are the pillows? Where are the pictures? Where's the stuff that makes us human, the stuff that makes us comfortable, right? When I look at this, it's so cold that I think it's intellectually dishonest. We can't sort of think of the future and begin to have these visions of the future that are so stylized and so devoid of humans. Now, on my next slide, I have a picture of what the future is actually going to look like. Do you want to see it? All right, that was pretty good. That was a little kind of, This is, you do know this is South by Southwest, right? I got to tell you, so I was, I kind of used this, I was talking to about 600 undergraduates, and right there, our future, literally. Do we have any undergraduates in the room? Anybody? There we go. You're the future. So literally, 600 of that guy in the back, right? And they're all there, and I'm the futurist, and I'm talking, I'm walking around, I'm gesturing, and I say, get to this point, and I go, who wants to see the future? And one guy way up in the back goes, sure. I was like, you're our future? I'm going to use you. You're our future, and all I get is, sure. Okay, here we go. Ready? Hold on to something. Bam! Now, being at Intel and being in high tech, right, this is the interactive side of South By, this is an awesome future for us, right? This woman has a laptop, she has a smartphone, she has a connected picture frame, and she has a connected TV. So for what we all do, this is pretty awesome. But what I like about this is it's human, right? She's got a whole bunch of junk on top of the chest of drawers. The drawer down on the bottom is open. She's in her bare feet, for heaven's sakes, right? It's full of all the stuff that makes us comfortable. So when I look at this, I think this is the world that I want to design for, right? This is the world that I want to kind of build for. This is a world that's populated by people. I want to actually live in this future. I don't want to live in this future, because this future looks like prison, right? I would rather live in this future, right? This future, even, you guys can't see this. Heck, I can barely see it. She has a pillow down there that actually says, chill out. That's the type of future, right? So this is how I sort of come at the visioning that I need to do for that 10 to 15 year time horizon. Okay, so how do we do it, right? How do we go about doing this? Well, the process that we use is called future casting. Future casting, if you remember nothing else about this presentation, please remember, I do not make predictions. I'm not that type of futurist. Invariably, during the Q&A, somebody is going to ask me, what will Intel's stock price be? I don't know. If I knew, I wouldn't be here. I would be very rich. Future casting is not about predicting the future. What we're doing with future casting is using a process to come up with the future. An actionable vision for the future that we can actually go out and build. Literally, the work that I do turns into about a 150-page specification that goes to the chip designers. And we understand that all of that design is all based around people, first and foremost. Actually based around humans. Imagine that. Actually around people, not the technology. And then we have a process for getting there. That's one of the things that when I talk with folks, especially in the lab, we begin to say that as we're moving in this direction, right, we can say we roughly think that the future is going to kind of look like this. We know we might want it to look like this, and we know we definitely don't want it to look like this. So what do we need to do to actually make it better? And that's really kind of the process that we use. And me being a geek, as I've already told you, of course, I have to have a quote from Isaac Asimov, right, who basically says that predicting the future is a hopeless and thankless task. And for me, prediction is of no use because it doesn't comprehend the complexity of the future. It doesn't comprehend the fact that the future isn't this fixed point on the horizon, right, that we're all kind of running towards and we can't do anything about. The future is made by the actions of people every day, and it's constantly moving. So if somebody gives you a prediction and they say, you know, in the year 2020, it's going to look like this, they're probably trying to sell you something. Usually that's what happens. So be suspect. Now all the other futurists are going to come and try to beat me up. Awesome. So what I want to do is, okay, so what does this look like? And so this is always a good barometer for the geeks in the room, the hardcore geeks. If you just got goosebumps by this slide I just put up, you are a hardcore geek. If not, you're normal and regular and probably have a very open and active life. I get goosebumps just talking about this. And it's a pretty simple idea, right, for what we have at Intel and at other companies as well. What we have is, over the last few decades, the size of computational power, right, the size of the chip, right, has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, literally from mainframe to PC, smaller and smaller. And the guys that I'm working with basically begin to model out that as we approach the year 2020, computational power approaches zero. Goosebumps? Anybody? The size of this thing, and actually some of the engineers actually say this is a very good example of computational power getting close to zero. The size of this and the what it looks like has nothing to do with the processor. It's really fast. It has everything to do with the screen and the battery of what we want to do with it. And if you think, for years we were saying, can we possibly get the mainframe computer to work? Can we possibly squeeze all this computational power into a PC? Can we actually make it a laptop? We're not doing that anymore. As it approaches zero, we can put it anywhere. So some of the work that I've been doing looking out past that is to say, okay, futurist, if this is true, how do we need to think about computing? And the first thing we need to think about is that computational power, computing, is not for computers anymore. Most of you know this, right? It's not about a PC, right? It's about this. There's computational power in that. There's computational power probably in the ceilings. We begin to think of computational power moving throughout our lives. And the question becomes, what do we want to do with it? Not can we do it, but what? What do we want to do with it? Where do we want to put it? So a lot of the models that I build begin to ask, what will it feel like to be a human in the year 2021? And one of the things that we've been working on, and this kind of describes that era of big data, that for many humans, all of us, in the era of big data, it will feel like data has a life of its own. Right? We're creating tons of data. I think you all know that. Lots and lots of sensor data, medical data, lots of preferences, surfing, all that sort of stuff. We're like huge, we're like gushers. We're fire hydrants of data. When that goes off, that data goes off into the cloud, it will feel like it has a secret life. And the reason why is because it will. It actually will have a secret life. But we always have to remember that when that data comes back to us, only when it comes in contact with human beings does that data have meaning. And we need to work so that the algorithms that develop this understand what it means to be a human. So the algorithms and the software understand what we are going to do with it. The next thing that we're looking at is saying, in the year 2021, computational power will get so small that these devices that we've talked about, and get ready for it, here's the big snazzy animation. Here we go. It disappears. Right, but it really does. We start to live in a world where computing and computation becomes a specter. We literally live in an environment of computational power. That really changes, for what we're all talking about, how we design hardware, how we design software, how we design services. Right? You might have, you know, this. You might have a smartphone, but this smartphone could be getting its information from 15 other computers that don't have screens, but this actually has a screen, and it's allowing you to interact with it. So how do we do that? And then the final piece, and then we're getting to the science fiction, because we're headed there. The final piece is something I've been calling the future of fear. And the future of fear, which again, every now and again makes Intel Legal very nervous when I say, I'm going to go talk about the future of fear. And they're like, Johnson, you can't talk about the future of fear. I'm like, just watch me. And the reason why is fear is the human experience around safety and security and around privacy. And so one of the things that I've been doing is talking to people about what they're worried about in the future, especially around technology. I mean, heck, you roll in and say that we're going to have a secret life of data and we're going to have a ghost of computing, people start getting freaked out, right? Probably some of you are probably a little freaked out about what it is. And so the conversations we start to ask is, well, why? Why are you worried? Not saying you shouldn't be, but why? And saying, okay, how do we pull away what we shouldn't be afraid of and actually identify what we should be afraid of? And this is actually what led us to the science fiction work that we've been doing. So this is a quote from my CTO, where he said that science and technology have progressed to the point where what we build is only constrained by the limits of our own imagination. Any goosebumps? Any geeks? Anybody? For me, having the chief technology officer of a company like Intel say it's no longer about science and technology, and what it's really about is the limits of our imagination, opens up an incredible opportunity for what we could actually build. So with that in mind, that brings the question, okay, so if we're actually going to do this design, if we're actually going to design this future, what do we need to design the future? What could possibly help us do that? Science fiction. I wish I could make this blink. Science fiction. See? It's pretty snazzy, right? Come on. There we go. Where's all my people who are loaded? There we go. You're a tough crowd. So, okay, so what does that actually mean? Well, this shouldn't surprise us, right? This shouldn't surprise us that we could actually use science fiction as a tool for technology development. Science fiction and science fact have had a long tradition of working together, right? This is back in 1916. Hugo Gernsback, of course, the Hugo Award in science fiction for the science fiction fans out there is named from Gernsback. And Gernsback was one of the first people to say that you need to put science fiction and science fact together. He was one of the first people to actually do it. He actually did it in this, it kind of got cut off a little bit, but this amazing publication, it's called The Electrical Experimenter. He actually said that it's not good enough to put the technical research there, that you actually have to have a vision. You actually have to use your imagination along with using your technical expertise. And then it started progressing forward, right? And we have, you know, come the 1930s and the 1940s, where you've got, again, Isaac Asimov, where Asimov said, wow, that is terribly cut off. Is there any way that we can fix the projector? Probably not. No. Okay, so Asimov's three laws, right? So what Asimov does in the 1930s is say, let's actually bring logic to science fiction. Why don't we put these laws, right, the three laws of robotics, and actually bring logic to science fiction stories? For many, many years before that, a lot of those science fiction stories were actually about humans go and create this awesome piece of technology, we try really hard, we create the awesome piece of technology, the awesome piece of technology comes alive, and then the awesome piece of technology kills us all. That's pretty much the story that happened for many, many years. Pretty much all based on Frankenstein, right? An amazing, amazing novel written by a teenage girl. But it was pretty much aped for a long time. What Asimov says is that no, if we're building them, can't we actually put logic in them? Can't we actually bring a logic to the system? And most of Asimov's stories are not actually conforming to the three laws. They're actually pushing on that logic. They're trying to break it. They're trying to experiment with what could actually happen if you created these robots with the three laws. And of course, this still has resonance today. You can't see my really cheesy picture of Will Smith here, but there's a really cheesy picture of Will Smith here, right? This is still happening, right? You still, when iRobot came out, it actually did quite well. And this still has resonance, right? This is still actually quite exciting. But then something really interesting happened around 2007, and I'm going to read this one to you. Is you started having a group of both science fiction authors and scientists who actually said, does science fiction actually get out into the front of science fact? Does it actually lead science fact? What it says here is, science has often followed cultural anticipation, not led it. Fiction and film have meditated upon upcoming social issues of robots and cyborgs for centuries. And in the book Beyond Human, they begin to sort of think about, all right, so what has science fiction taught us? And this is just one example. Recently, there's been lots and lots of examples. Actually, one of your hometown boys, Bruce Sterling, actually does quite a lot of writing about this, right? Saying that science fiction can be a really powerful tool. And then also, you even take authors like Neal Stephenson, who's doing the kind of, is starting his new project around kind of looking out around space travel and saying that we need to have strong technical-minded stories so that we can push our engineering. So this idea said, okay, so something else, you've got science fiction being able to have a way to prototype out these ideas, actually using science fiction as a lead for it. And then here's a bit of a personal story for me. In 2007, one of the things that I was actually working on, this was before I was, was a little bit sort of me working at Intel, is I was working on doing a lot of work in robotics. And do you guys know about the Uncanny Valley? So Maury's Uncanny Valley? All right, thank you. Nodding. Woohoo! So the Uncanny Valley basically says that you've got the familiarity on the vertical, on the horizontal, you have human likeness. And as we go along, humans really dig robots. We really dig robots. They're really cool. They're really awesome. They're really awesome. They start looking more and more human. They're really awesome. They're really awesome. And then we reach a point where they kind of look human, but not enough. And then it drops, and they freak us out. Literally, we think of them as zombies and corpses. And then as we move forward, it kind of shoots back up. So there's this, and that's that dip. And Morrison called it the Uncanny Valley. And it became this thing in robotics that they literally, they're trying to jump, is what they call it. How do we jump, kind of Evel Knievel style, the Uncanny Valley, to get to the other side? The Uncanny Valley also, strangely enough, popularized by, was it 30 Rock, right? 30 Rock, and talking about video games and pornography. Who knew? I wonder if Morrison is like, oh my God. So I was actually doing work in this area and actually had an idea for how we could jump the Uncanny Valley. And I did a piece of science fiction. I'm a science fiction author as well. And I wrote this book called Fake Plastic Love. And Fake Plastic Love says, what if we don't try to make robots look human? What if we try to make them look like celebrities? Because as we all know, celebrities are not human. All right, there we go. There's my South By people. And not only that, what if we have the robot talk like a tabloid magazine, right? To have that kind of talk, that pattern. Could that kind of be a way to have sort of acceptance? And that's, you know, it's also a science fiction story. Lots of things blow up, people die, all that type of stuff. But it was really kind of tinkering with that idea. And I sort of wrote it, kind of went out there. It was a fine little book. But then I get this call from these professors in Ulm, Germany, these roboticists. I have a huge weakness for right scientists and roboticists and AI guys. And they called me and said, well, we read your book and we really liked it. We're thinking about what we might do with it. Could you come and talk? And what this is, I do have to say this again, this is for the geeks in the room. Do digital homes dream of electric families? Was this lecture and paper I gave saying, you know, kind of thinking, you know, the way that we think about it, it goes back to that streamlined future, right? The way that we think about digital homes and intelligent environments, we sort of strip them of humanity. We like to think of them as the Jetsons, which that's not really what the future is going to look like. The future, again, is going to be full of people, and it's going to be messy. And it was sort of talking about this stuff. And at the very end of it, I sort of said this, again, which you can't read, which basically says, could we use these futuristic visions? If you begin to write science fiction based on science fact, could you then start using that as a development tool? Could you come up with a framework to actually take advantage of all the imaginative fiction and actually use it to develop better technologies? And then we did it. So if anybody ever wanted to be a futurist for a large tech corporation, get your cameras out. Because this is basically my job in one slide. What we do here is this: the piece in the middle is how you develop technologies, right, at any software company, hardware company, what have you. See, that guy's coming out. See, the guy from behind, I got the guy from behind the board to come out and take a picture. And we've all done it, right, and especially in tech development. You have exploration, you have development, you have deployment. In my lab, we have anthropologists and ethnographers, we have designers, we have tech people, and we get an understanding of who is actually going to use the product so we can understand the people first and foremost, like they said. Then we understand what are they going to do, what's the experience that we want people to have, and then we start to spec out how will they do it, and we go through this development. So it's very much an experience-driven technology process. But what we wanted to do with science fiction, and literally specifically what my job is to extend that out and say, okay, how do we get an early understanding of technology and an early understanding of science, not only hard tech, but, you know, hard tech and statistical tech and social science, what have you. Get an understanding of what that technology is. Start to think about the science fact and then begin to prototype it. It's something we call science fiction prototyping. And so if you write a story, you can begin to say, well, any good story is really about people, or most good stories that draw us in are about people. Really good science fiction stories are also about people. So if you write a science fiction story based upon science fact, you begin to see the real human impact of that science on real people. And then you can ask yourself, do you like that? What's the worst thing that can happen? What are the ethical implications? What are the legal implications? What's all the stuff? So it literally becomes a prototype for the development. And then you can feed that back into the research process and you begin a conversation. So you use science fiction to begin a conversation with all the people involved. Get ready. So remember the title of this? The title is Where Do Science Fiction and Science Fact Meet? Right there. The idea that we can actually use science fiction based on science fact as a tool that begins to get people talking and allows us to prototype it out and allows us to do it through multiple iterations. This is what gets us there. And it's something that we use and that I've used inside of Intel for a while now. And what this means is that science fiction gives us this language so that we can have a conversation about the future. So you may not be a synthetic biologist, but if I give you a science fiction story based upon synthetic biology, hopefully you're not a synthetic biologist. Are you a synthetic biologist? No, okay. You could have lied and been like, yeah? What's up? If I give you a story based on synthetic biology, you and I can then have a conversation about it. Do you like it? Do you not like it? What freaks you out? It goes back to that future of fear stuff. So it gives us a language to have that conversation and allows us to actually have better software requirements and hardware requirements and all of that. And this is what led us to the Tomorrow Project. Now, the Tomorrow Project is the public side of my work and the work that we're doing. It is the public side of this science fiction prototyping, where we got together with science fiction authors and started saying, let's write science fiction based on science fact. And we not only did it with best-selling science fiction authors, but we also did it with universities. We also did it with sort of amateurs and people who were just interested. We did it with scientists. We did it with a whole bunch of people. And the whole idea is, like, let's start getting science fiction out there, getting it into the hands of people so that we can have that conversation. And so in the spirit of that, free copies of the book! Yay! So if you go after this, if you go over across the street, if you have time, to the bookstore, we're actually giving away copies of The Tomorrow Project. And if you can't get across the street, that's fine. They'll be there tomorrow as well. They've got quite a few copies of it. And also, if you can't get there in time, you can get it online. If you just go to the Tomorrow Project, we're giving it away. We're not selling it. And just for the nuts and bolts, and also for the authors and the any lawyers in the room, we are Intel doesn't keep the copyright. We actually don't want it. We actually want them to keep the copyright. We don't sell it, we'll never make money on it. That's not the point. The point literally is to have these conversations, to bring people together, to bring scientists and authors together, to develop these stories and then get them in the hands of people. And this is something that we've been doing for the last 2 years, and I want to tell you some of the stories that we've worked on and some of the things that we've found. But it's all free, it will always be free. And even the science fiction authors, they're like, really, I get to keep the copyright? And I'm like, not only that, I want you to sell it. I actually want you to get it into as many places as possible, because the more hands that we can get it into, the better. So probably the most effective, and one of the most exciting ones we did, was one called Knights of the Rainbow Table by Cory Doctorow. Has anybody ever heard of this kid, Cory Doctorow? Yeah, there we go. It's like, this is his audience. So what Cory and I sat down and started talking about was the future of security, literally the future of fear, right? What would it mean if you actually were able to create a cluster of servers that could create a rainbow table large enough to crack every password? So in Corey's story, what he writes about is literally the moment that all passwords go away. That's literally the point in it. So he literally starts writing, what would that be like? And he looks at, okay, the technology that went into it. And he did lots of research with us. He did lots of research with Google. I mean, he's Cory Doctorow, for heaven's sake. So he did all this sort of research. And he started saying, well, here's how you could possibly do it. And then we started looking at the effects. What would the legal effects be? What would the effects be with the media? But for me, where the story really, really sings, and I won't give too much away about it, I'll let you read it, is he talks about what it would feel like. Like, literally, you wake up one morning and everything about you is online, and everybody can see it. And he talks about, in a world of no passwords, what might that look like? And he doesn't offer answers yet. That's really not the point. The idea is to explore what that would feel like and what that would mean. And so we released this book. This is the one that we did for 2011. We released this at Comic-Con in New York City. And it was great. We had an awesome time. It was right, super geek fest. And Cory and I actually did a panel like this. It was just Cory and I. And we talked about the story. And we talked about what happens if passwords go away and you can actually do it. And we talked about security and about your passwords and, you know, how most of us really have really, really weak passwords. And really, we started talking about, just bantering like a couple of geeks, about, okay, this is probably what your password is like. And we started talking to people and saying, well, your password is probably this. Your password is probably this. And we freaked everybody out, right? We didn't mean to, but the idea is that as you start digging into this stuff, you really start to kind of get a fact-based understanding of what security's like. So I like to say now, and I haven't told Cory this, but what I like to say now is that the Knights of the Rainbow Table should also be known as Cory Doctorow Knows Your Password. Which Cory's a pretty good guy, so that's not too bad. But it's that idea, and for me, that discussion, literally even saying that Cory Doctorow knows your password, that's great, right? Because now we're having a conversation based upon real science, right? Not based upon somebody trying to scare you, somebody trying to get you to buy something, somebody trying to get elected. Actually, the technology building that we need to do. So another story that we did in the previous one from last year, which is we did in Germany, we did with Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas Rushkoff, anybody? Doug? Yeah. So Douglas Rushkoff is a media theorist, and like he's, Doug's basically a troublemaker. And so we went to Doug and said, hey, can you write us up a science fiction story based on science fact? And he kind of smiled and said, okay. He goes, what if I wrote about the last day of work? So literally, you guys at Intel create the fastest chips ever, and everything gets super smart. And what happens if they get so smart that no human has to work anymore? And it becomes actually a meditation on work itself. What does work mean to us as human beings? What is the value that it gives to us? What do the value of sort of local communities mean? And it's not a happy story, I'll tell you. And it's really interesting because he doesn't use it to be about technology at all. He simply assumes a lot of the stuff that I talked to you about, the secret life of data, the ghost of computing, these things beginning to happen. And he really starts to say, you know, okay, cowboy, so that's what happens. What's the human effect at a very, very deep level, as really only Doug can write about? So for me, and he and I talked about this, and he does know this one, for me, I also think that this story should be called Don't Forget About the Humans. Or, in my case, Douglas Rushkoff says, don't forget about the humans. That as we do this development, as we're kind of rushing forward, creating faster machines, that we need to, not only in science fiction, but also nonfiction, in media, online, be having the conversation of the human impact. And start saying, this is what we want, this is what we don't want. And to start thinking about that. And then one other one I want to tell you about is actually one that I did a while back with those scientists, called the Dr. Simon Egerton Stories. And this is based upon some research in AI that we've been doing, looking at robots that make both logical decisions and illogical decisions, make both rational and irrational decisions. And so they told me this when I was in a bar. And I was in a bar, and all good things happen in bars, right? And so I was in a bar, and I literally had a pint in my hand, and I said, hang on, wait. You're making irrational robots? And he goes, uh-huh, yeah. He goes, it makes perfect sense. If you look at the way our brains work, our brains make both good decisions and bad decisions, and that's why we learn. That's why we actually can be much more robust in complex environments. Robots and most AI are stupid as all get out because they only make the right decision, and they're so much slower. So what we're working on is creating these AIs that make really bad decisions and then learn from them. And then also he said, and as a part of that, we're taking that information and putting it into sort of different personas. So this is a collection of behaviors, this is a collection of behaviors, all kind of learning. And he said, what we're really trying to do is get the robots to switch from one persona to another persona. Say like you're a learner, or learning persona to a worker persona, or from like a child persona to like a teacher persona, right? They're trying to work on that. So they're telling me all these stories. And I said, okay. And I ended up writing a prototype, because I said, you do realize that if you have a robot that's making both rational and irrational decisions, and is switching between personas, it's gonna look like it has free will. Like, it's literally gonna start doing stuff and you don't know why. It's like, that will make a really good story. And so I started playing around and I created this little guy, this little domestic robot named Jimmy. And Jimmy has been in these stories, and we created this thing called the gin and tonic test, where in the story, Jimmy is making gin and tonics for the professor, or for the doctor, Dr. Simon Egerton. And so Jimmy walks over and he makes a gin and tonic and he walks back and he gives it to the doctor, and the doctor says, thank you, Jimmy, and sets it down, doesn't drink it, just sets it down, sits for a moment, and then turns back and says, Jimmy, will you make me a gin and tonic? Jimmy says, okay, walks over, makes the gin and tonic, comes back, gives it back to him. He says, thank you very much, doesn't drink it and sets it down, and then says, Jimmy, will you make me another drink? And what he's doing is he's testing these decisions, right? He's testing how you make rational and irrational decisions, how you switch personas, which I just found completely fascinating. And so I wrote the prototype, sort of sent it out to the scientists, and they came back with this. You can't see this. It's okay. It's really small. What it actually is called the quantum persona transfer function. What this is actually called the gin and tonic test. So they said, this is it. This is what we need to do, the scenario that we need to kind of think about what that effect would be to actually have these robots appear as if they have free will. And I was in Barcelona when I presented this out, and they turned to me, and this is one of the scientists turned to me and just very casually said, oh yeah, and by the way, we're gonna make Jimmy. I'm like, oh, what? He said, we're gonna make Jimmy, we're gonna make the AI, and we're gonna build Jimmy to actually do this. Which, in keeping with the also known as sort of theme that you guys have probably hep to, for me now, the Dr. Simon Egerton stories should be known as, you got to be freaking kidding me, you're going to build my robot? That's freaking awesome. Only I didn't use the word freaking. And so it just goes to this effect that I think as you begin to kind of think about it, because there's so many possibilities, again, as Justin was saying, that there's so much possibility out there that it really is about our imagination. And using science fiction as a way to kind of explore that imagination and give us those models. So for 2012, we're kind of going forward. You can't read all this. So one of the things that we're doing is we're taking these stories. Like I said, they're all free online, and I'll have the URL up in a minute, but you've all probably Googled it anyway. But also, we're recording conversation with the authors so that we can, again, have that conversation. So take what Corey wrote, and I sat down with Corey, and we actually talked about it. So every story that's in that anthology that you saw, there's actually a podcast or a video of me having a conversation or somebody else having a conversation with that author. And literally is kind of getting it out there. And then also, to seed more conversation, you'll see, we sit down and talk to people who are doing work around DNA sequencing and biochemical work. There's folks who are doing, we had conversations with a synthetic biologist. We talked to folks about computer vision. So literally, just sitting down with these scientists, actual scientists, which often, a lot of these scientists work in the basement, I have learned. I spend a lot of time in the basements of universities talking to scientists, which, yeah, it's not a bad gig. But sitting around and saying, okay, tell me about what you're building, and then let's talk about those implications. And so we put it up as a way to actually, again, foster and get some more of that conversation going. Also, as a part of the Tomorrow Project, we're going two other places that I can officially announce. The first is we're going and doing something called the Tomorrow Project UK, where we're going to work with the New Scientist magazine. So they're kind of like the Scientific American of the UK. They're creating a quarterly called ARC, A-R-C, where it's literally science fiction based on science fact, where we've committed to not only publish the science fiction and talk about the science fact, but actually create a website where we can all kind of log on and talk about stuff. So we can't always do this, right? We can't sit in a room full of people. So we're actually going to have a discussion forum up on board. I hope you all will please go. I wish I had all of your emails. To actually get people to start talking about reading these science fiction stories and talking about what it means to them, what they're scared of, what they're looking for, and then what we've committed to is to do something with it. So it's not just a discussion board, it's a discussion board. We'll actually take those discussions about the science fiction stories and write new science fiction stories based upon that feedback to maybe even change it. Not change the original story, but think about the vision a little bit differently. We've also committed to even go and do science fact articles. So if somebody goes, I want to know more about this thing about synthetic biology, to actually sit down with a synthetic biologist if somebody's freaked out about it, then actually talk about it. And so we want to keep this conversation going. And sometimes we'll go do videos with those folks. And then we're also going to do one down in Brazil, which I'm incredibly excited about. We're going to go to Brazil and actually do, and it's going to be in English, Spanish, and Portuguese, and look at issues of what's going on in Brazil. We partnered with a place called the Museum of the Future. And it's literally a museum that's built looking 50 years out. And we're going to go down there and do the same thing and try to get different perspectives. And every year we're going to go to different places. So please keep an eye out for these. And also once these discussion boards keep up, I'll kind of go and tweet it out and try to get everybody involved. But we really want to get as much people talking about it because then I want to do something with it. I actually want to take it and do more fiction or do more nonfiction. So one of the conversations all through 2011 that I had with a lot of these scientists and a lot of folks, especially people like Cory Doctorow and Doug Rushkoff and Werner Vinge and a lot of other scientists that said, we're at a really unique time where we can actually change the future, right? We can literally build things, have ideas, get them out there, and actually launch them and watch them go, right? The rate of technological change and progression has allowed us to do all this amazing stuff. So I said, how do we change the future? How do we affect the future? I asked some folks, who are the five people you have to talk to really make change? And what we came back with is that it's really not about that. That the real way to change the future is to change the story people tell themselves about the future that they will live in. Right, on one side is incredibly easy, right? You write an anthology of science fiction based on science fact, you give it to people, boom, there's your story, there's your future. But then the other side, I think that's incredibly profound. Because as we start to think about changing that story that we tell ourselves, it also means it changes what we do. It changes our educational decisions. It changes the policies we make. It changes the technologies that we build. But we actually say, I don't want to live in this future. I actually want to live in this better future, right? Actually, we can make a better future. And it sounds really cheesy, but it's true. We can actually make a better future through science fiction by changing that story and having those conversations. So I got one more slide, and then we got questions. So start getting your questions ready. And especially for the drunk folks over there, lots of questions. This is a personal story. So when I was coming up in industry, I was a speechwriter. It's one of the things I did. It was before I was at Intel and all that. And in all of the presentations that I wrote for this one executive, I had to include a picture of dogs playing poker. I didn't ask. I was very young. I didn't ask why. I said, yes, sir, you got it. Picture of dogs playing poker. Very good. And I got really good at it, right? So if there was a picture frame on the wall, I put a picture of dogs playing poker, right? If there was a TV somewhere, I'd put a picture of dogs playing poker on the TV. You guys know, right? You know the picture, right? It's got the little bulldog with the card in his toe. And then finally, we were going to part ways. And so I had to ask the guy, I said, you got to tell me, why did we have to have a picture of dogs playing poker in every single presentation? And he kind of smiled at me and said, Brian, everybody loves pictures of dogs playing poker. Why wouldn't you do that? So I've learned. I took on that mantle. But in all my presentations, I don't include pictures of dogs playing poker. What I do include are pictures of animals using technology. Now, the longer you look at this, the more freaked out you're going to be. And actually, a couple weeks ago, I showed this picture in a presentation, and there was a guy from Petco, the chief marketing officer from Petco, was in the back, and he went, "That's brilliant!" So that's, if you guys want to follow, that's my Twitter handle, is @IntelFuturist. That's the URL, which you can't read, but if you just Google Tomorrow Project, you'll find it. And I just really want to say thank you so much. I hope you'll join the conversation with the Tomorrow Project. I think it could be really, really exciting. And we'll take some questions. So thank you very much. So the question is, that robot, the Jimmy robot, has it come to life? No, actually what they're doing is they are building it in the lab right now, and they are going to do an open source design competition to actually give people the tools and let them open source the AI.
Step up. So I'm curious your perspective on the predilection towards dystopianism in science fiction and how to reconcile that with the fact that, as a lot of research has recently shown, pessimists are overwhelmingly bad at predicting the future. Optimists are better, but they're usually not optimistic enough.
Yep. So the question is, if you guys couldn't hear it, was how do we reconcile that you have a lot of dystopic or pessimistic futures? That's a great question. And as a futurist, I'm kind of a declared optimist, which doesn't make me a very popular futurist, right? Because if I say everything's going to be awesome, everybody goes like, meh, whatever. Because the fact of the matter is, pessimism and dystopias make really good stories. Like when things blow up, it makes a really good story. Conflict makes a good story. I actually don't think that dystopic visions of the future are bad at all. I actually think from a technology standpoint, as you are developing them, they actually can help. Because again, it's better sometimes to define this is the world we don't want. I mean, the example for me is always sort of 1984, because it you know, with Big Brother and George Orwell saying this very complex sort of totalitarian government that uses technology to spy on its people. It's a pretty in-depth concept, but the idea that you could have that now and people go, oh, Big Brother, I don't want that. So you have this, and the science fiction story did that, right? The story got us to understand what Orwell was seeing and actually pushed us away, or at least gave us some There Be Dragons there. And I think it's also one of the things, I mean, that's what Corey did in Little Brother as well, with his book, is saying, you know, let's continue to think about this stuff. So I actually, when I work with people with the Tomorrow Project, I actually encourage them to write dystopic futures, just so we can begin to kind of think about, okay, what's the bad stuff? But to ultimately say, no, you need to be pragmatic, right? In the end, it's not to be fatalistic, to say it's all going to go bad and the world blows up. Well, that doesn't do us any good. What do we do with that? The idea being, you could say that here's a technology, and if a technology is used in this way, really bad stuff could happen. That's okay, because then we can start to say, okay, how do we not do that? How do we make sure that that doesn't happen? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Maren. I just went to the San Francisco Writers Conference a few weeks ago, and there was hundreds and hundreds of people there. And the one panel on science fiction writing was almost held in a closet. So I'm wondering if it matters that most people don't read science fiction or care about it. I notice you're giving your book away for free. If just a few people care, is that enough?
What do we do about a world that doesn't care about science fiction? Well, the good news is that from a science fiction as a genre is hugely popular, mainly because of film, right? Because film, I mean, the top, what, seven, I think, highest grossing films of all time are science fiction films. So science fiction as a genre, huge, right? But science fiction writing, I think, has sort of suffered from the decline of a lot of writing. And for a long time, science fiction has had this sort of, you know, it's this sort of ghettoized thing, right? It's only for, you know, 13-year-old boys and stuff like that. You know, I think for a certain set of folks. And also, when I go, because I do a lot of work with schools, and a lot of the schools that I work with are not colleges, it's actually high school and junior high and elementary school, to actually use science fiction as a way to get kids to think science and math is cool. To actually show them, I literally can give them that little story about Jimmy, and they read it, and they're like, oh, that's cool, and he's cute, and that's awesome. And I go, oh, by the way, this is what it's based on. Here's this guy. His name is Dr. Vic Callahan. He's actually building this. And it kind of gets them. So the on-ramp. So I guess maybe we're saying that maybe if we get them young, maybe we can sort of bring them in, because there are a lot of folks, I think, who get fascinated by it, but you're right. I think it's the side, but I think we can do it.
Being that Intel's mostly a chip company, do you find that after you design a chip for a specific purpose, like it seems like you do in your lab, do you find that other companies, HTC, Sony, whatever, you know, Samsung, take them and use them in ways you never intended, for better or for worse? And specifically, like anything Intel designed 10 years ago that people are using today in ways, you know, that Intel didn't intend it?
That's a great question. And it's something that I've been doing a lot of writing about recently. It's something I've been thinking of as engineering uncertainty, right? That the idea that the more uncertainty you can engineer into your piece of technology, the better you have future-proofed it, right? This idea of unintended consequences is actually a great thing. Right, and the poster child for this is was born here at South by Southwest. It's Twitter, right? Twitter was created to find out where you're going to have a beer. That's why Twitter was created, right? What are you doing now? Where are you? What are you doing? And it got really popular, surprise, surprise, at South by Southwest, because where are we going to have a beer? Where are we going to go? Right? It's really cool. They had no idea that just a few years later it would change the geopolitical face of the world. But it was because it was open, right? Because it was really just a way to communicate, and it wasn't sort of hemmed in. So one of the things that I'm actually doing with Intel is encouraging them to put more uncertainty, right? To have it be more open, to have it be as flexible as possible. And even down to some of these programmable radios in the chip, if you want to get super geeky, like literally you can software program them. So I think it's actually a good thing when there's unintended consequences, and that we should actually encourage it. We should engineer for it, because it actually opens it up for much, much more innovation.
Hi, the science fiction writers of the 1950s and 60s, a lot of the things that they wrote about have come true. So if you think about Asimov and his idea of psychohistory, and you look at big data and social media today, we can today predict the behaviors of large groups of people based on what big data is telling us. I'd like you to comment on contemporary science fiction writers, people like Ian McEwan or Ian M. Banks, and you know the sort of science fiction that they're writing about, and where do you see a possible future emerging out there? Which one of them is perhaps getting it right? Is it the culture novels? Is it where it's a, you know, who do you like reading?
And who do I like to read?
And where do, which one of them do you think is writing stuff that might actually come true?
Well, I think there's a whole group of science fiction authors who, number one, a lot of science fiction is just about telling a good story, right? It's a thrill ride, it's a popcorn ride, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's awesome. I love when stuff blows up. I've confessed to you constantly throughout this. I like Transformers the movie. It's terrible, but I love it. It's big robots and stuff blow up. Come on. I told you I'm a geek. But there is a group, I think, of writers that are science-minded, right, who actually do the research and who are trying to make change. And a lot of the guys that you talked about, and some gals, had an opinion. Like Asimov had an opinion about what the future should look like, and his fiction pointed you in that direction. Heinlein, whether you liked it or not, had an opinion and pointed us in a way. Le Guin has an opinion. Like all these authors have an opinion. I like people who have opinions. And those are like the kind of people that I read. Big fan of Cory Doctorow, of course, as you can imagine. I'm a big fan of Charlie Strauss. And very specifically, the Halting State books, right? Those books at looking at what's happening. I'm a huge fan of your hometown boy, Bruce Sterling. And I'm looking at him right now. But it's really that idea of people who are using this science fiction that is informed, that are actually trying to make social change, technological change, getting people to think differently. And I think some of the authors that you mentioned kind of go into that cadre as well. And those are the people who excite me.
So you've talked about science fiction as an aid to imagination, as allowing us to think bigger. But it has also been guilty of constraining our imagination as well. I mean, jetpacks in the future is the classic kind of example, or, you know, you can't talk about gestural interfaces without Minority Report coming up, and it's like, oh, well, now we're tied into that future. What's the answer? Is it more science fiction, like what Neal Stephenson's trying to do? It's like, do we need a wide variety of science fiction to stop it being constrained?
I love that. I think more science fiction. The more science fiction we could have, the better. No, I actually know those guys. Alex McDowell's the guy who built that Minority Report world. He's actually a world builder, and they brought in scientists for all the failings, or the, if you're a UI designer that drives you crazy about this, right, that taps something, right? And they literally brought in scientists, right? They brought in folks, they brought in the MIT folks to actually do it, and it speaks to something. So I think you're right. Sometimes it speaks to something that we want as humans. It, we may not be able to do it, like the jetpack, right? And that would be terrible, by the way. Or somebody's talking, imagine having flying cars in Texas. This would be a very bad thing. So they were saying that, but it taps into something that we want as humans. So this is why I go back to the, let's make sure it's based on real approachable science. And that's why I usually like to involve working scientists to say, they're actually in a basement somewhere working on the stuff, or they're in CERN, or they're somewhere. What are the implications of that work? So I think for me, in that way, it kind of keeps it a little bit more kind of reined in to possibility.
Hello.
Hey.
This could be a really short answer. It might just be that you need to clarify something for me, because I'm a bit confused by something you said at the beginning. At the beginning, you said it takes 5 years for Intel to actually develop a chip. So how does that fit with things like Moore's Law and Crider's Law? Does that mean that actually the technical development of stuff can't keep up with that law and those curves, if it takes 5 years to actually put something in place?
Does my question make actually sense? I can't hear you.
Oh. What's, can't hear me.
Can you speak up?
Should I get closer? Can you hear this?
Yeah.
Okay. So at the beginning of the talk, you said it takes 5 years to develop a chip.
Yep.
Does that mean that the implementation of stuff actually can't keep up with Moore's Law and Crider's Law?
So, oh, I understand, yeah. No, not at all. It literally takes, it's actually 5 to 10 years.
Right.
Literally our design process, right? We are, if nothing else, Intel is a manufacturing company that makes a complex product on a massive scale. The design process that we use to do that takes about 5 to 10 years. So as we start literally speccing out the chip, they need to have an understanding today of what people will want to do. And it's just to basically get it that small, to do all the QA, to do all the stuff to get it out the door, takes that long. No, I mean, actually, Moore's Law, at least in the 10 to 15 years that that I'm sort of looking at, looks pretty good. I mean, it's we're doing pretty good.
Hi, in your two slides contrasting the what will the future look like, I couldn't help but notice the resemblance in the more optimistic slide, the woman reclining in bed with all of her needs sort of within arm's reach, to the people reclining in WALL-E, the movie, with all their needs at arm's reach, probably twice or three times as large as we are now, maybe half or a third as apparently intelligent. So how do we reconcile this, you know, how do we create a vision for the future that's not about reclining and just having everything at your reach? How do we avoid the WALL-E dystopia?
I think you write science fiction stories about it that encourage it. I think that you change the story that people are telling themselves. I think you're right, that a lot of times we've been given this vision that's a consumptive vision. And we need to change that. And I think there are some people who are doing writing about that, but that consumptive vision, that McDonald's of the future, that sort of, is pretty sexy to a lot of people, right? And I think we need to change that narrative, right? But it was a lot of work. It's a lot of work to be done, because a lot of people think it's pretty sexy. One last one, and then we got to be done.
Thanks. I guess my question is, when you think about your vision for the future and in the group that you work with, when you're trying to articulate that future, how do you accommodate for the scale and complexity of people, right? Because the future that kind of you talked about had a lot to do with what I think of as the typical like moderate to high income American person. And so the planet's growing very exponentially and people are kind of all over the place. How do you capture all of these different futures and how your technology or your vision will, you know, interact with all of those different people and their different challenges?
It's a great question, and it's probably can't be answered in the time and in depth that it deserves. There is some stuff that I've written online about it that actually gets really deep into the development process of how we actually do that. What we do once we've sort of specced out this vision, what we then do is we begin to look at, okay, what will it look like in India? What will it look like in here? So sort of understanding, if you remember that, the futurist graph that I showed, the sort of the here's where the science fiction meets science fact, that next thing was the who will actually use it, and it's in that who that we really get into the nuts and bolts from a social science standpoint and go, okay, let's understand from a science-based, social science-based understanding of those humans, what they need, what, you know, what they're surrounded by, what their infrastructure is, so that we can take that experience, and if it's applicable to them, actually build it for them. That's the short of it. All right, I believe I'm out of time. Thank you all very much.